Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
This week on whether or not a new oil pipeline project in North Dakota can proceed. The Dakota Access Pipeline Project is being opposed by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, who say they did not have enough input in the planning. They have cultural and environmental concerns. Pipeline backers and the Army Corps of Engineers insist the tribe did have input into the project and that all appropriate rules have been followed. Protests have taken place at the construction site. The developer has now hired private security. Yesterday, video surfaced showing private guards using pepper spray on protesters, as well as guard dogs. This hour on the Joy Cardine Show, we'll talk about the project and the protests and the implications of both. What are your thoughts on the Dakota Access Pipeline? Do you hope the judge allows the construction to continue or orders it to be halted? And what questions do you have about the project? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. Talk at WPR.org. Or you can post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Joining me to talk about this issue this morning is Barry Rabe, a professor in the University of Michigan's Gerald Ford School of Public Policy and the director of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. He also holds appointments in the School of Natural Resources and Environment and the program in the environment. In addition, he's a non-resident senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution. Barry Rabe, welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Good morning.
So this is a pretty big story, but it's one that we haven't heard anywhere near as much about as we might have had this not been a presidential election year. I'm guessing that's the main reason that we haven't been hearing a lot about it.
Well, I think that's right. I also think that the Dakota Access Pipeline gains attention as we've now addressed the Keystone Pipeline, which was a much bigger pipeline. There was an international component and really kind of dominated a lot of the discussion and thinking about new pipelines for moving energy. With that passage of Keystone, Dakota Access really goes to the top of the list in terms of being a big, multi-state, complicated project. It did go through a very extended federal agency review process, the four states that would be crossed diagonally through this. Had gone through permit processes, but now we have indeed begun to see significant protests in North Dakota, as you mentioned, but also in some other parts of this pipeline where farmers have raised concerns or other landholders who would be affected by this. But really the focus right now is on, as you say, this issue with the Standing Rock Sioux and a federal judge soon to decide what happens with all of this. Does it go forward? Do we stall? What comes next? And we don't know that yet.
Well, you kind of gave us a little bit of an overview, but let's describe this project for those who may not be terribly familiar with the Dakota Pipeline. It crosses four states, several rivers, including the Missouri and the Mississippi, I believe. What is the purpose of this pipeline? What's it supposed to do?
Sure. First, this is a long pipeline. It's almost 1,200 miles. It would begin in southern North Dakota, right in the heart of big oil production territory, the so-called Bakken Shale. It would then cut diagonally through parts of South Dakota, Iowa, and into Illinois. And the terminal point for this would be in a small town called Katoka. It's about an hour and a half or 2 hours east of St. Louis in central southern Illinois. So it's a long, long stretch. This would move almost 500,000 barrels of oil a day from that rich supply in North Dakota. And to some extent, it would replace the existing approach, which has been to rely heavily on trains to transport. And of course, one of the factors that's been driving expanded interest in pipelines is not only because we're producing a lot more oil through fracking techniques in North Dakota, but in other places, and need to connect that oil. but also this issue of the trains and the safety and the reliability of those trains after some particularly horrific incidents a few years back with some loss of life and a number of incidents.
Yeah, and
although they raise many questions.
Well, and there are certainly risks anytime you transport something volatile, and so whether it's a pipeline or whether it's a tank car, there's always an opportunity for Murphy's Law to enter in. There are people who believe that pipelines aren't safe, just as people believe that tank cars aren't safe. And we do have some incidents that have happened, and so people are concerned. Are environmental concerns the main issue here?
I think so, but I would say that they are likely a range of environmental concerns. One of the biggest issues that's been raised by the Standing Rock Sioux Committee community is that this would pass not through their reservation, but ancestral lands near the Missouri River. And they're concerned about disruption to those ancestral lands, possible risks and the like. The biggest concern, of course, is across the length of this pipeline is the possibility of a spill. We've seen some of these. In 2013, there was a big spill, over 860,000 gallon boil on a farm in North Dakota. In Michigan, only an hour or so west from where I'm speaking to you, in 2010, over 800,000 gallons were spilled into the Kalamazoo River. So, as you point out, there's no surefire, always reliable method of moving oil or energy in general from one point to another, and pipelines do have their issues. I think another important factor here is that, you know, we often talk about infrastructure as being a challenge in the U.S., highways, bridges, and so forth. We have a huge infrastructure of oil pipelines, and about half of those pipelines across the U.S. are 50 or more years old. Overall in the U.S., we have over 2.5 million miles of pipelines. Again, over half of those pipelines are 50 years old. In some cases, we're talking about new pipeline development. In some cases, we're talking about replacement. And a lot of this reflects the fact that we are producing in the U.S. a lot more of our own oil and gas than we were 5, 10, or 15 years ago because of the big fracking boom. And with that come these issues.
Mm-hmm. The Dakota Access Pipeline is just 9 feet shorter than the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, but would only carry about 70% of the oil volume as was proposed for Keystone. Let's compare the main points of these two projects, how they're similar and how they're different.
For sure. In many ways, the technology is really pretty similar. There are some differences just given the actual nature of the oil being inserted into the pipeline. You talked about some of the Keystone differences. The oil in Alberta is a little different, the substance of it, than in the North Dakota case. But at the end of the day, this is a technology that's really pretty similar. Probably the biggest single difference in the Keystone case is that crossed an international border from the U.S. into Canada. This meant, along with all of the other permits, the role of state agencies, there was a role for international considerations. This is when the president became involved. This is when the Secretary of State, John Kerry, became involved. And it was really at that stage of the review process, this question of energy crossing an international border, that Keystone really flared up. Plus, it was providing a signal that the U.S. was, in effect, supporting the expanded drilling for oil in Alberta and these very controversial oil sands, which are much more energy intensive to extract the oil than they are in other kinds of places.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with that, you then shift to Dakota Access or a number of other pipelines where everything is taking place within the U.S. There aren't proposals here to ship this outside the U.S., but you have these long distances from where we drill for the oil and then where it's going to be stored and refined and then distributed toward population centers. North Dakota is a long, long way away from where most ultimate consumers are going to use this in their cars, vehicles, or however else the oil is going to be used. that's what brings this one really front and center at a point where, you know, we've become accustomed to lower oil and gas prices, but with it, it underscores some of the risks, both from spills, but then other factors as well.
The kind of oil that's produced in the Bakken field, we didn't invite you on here as an expert in petrochemicals, but there's a perfectly good refinery in Superior, which seems to be a lot closer to North Dakota than Illinois is. Could they have routed this pipeline to Superior and refined the oil here?
It's a great question. I don't want to. My petrochemical skills are profoundly limited.
And mine are even more limited, so I think we're in trouble. Let's skip the question. It just seems that, you know what, we're almost at news time, but I do want to come back to this because the why of this is important, and we will come back to that. We're talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline issue, the protests that are going on there, all the political and economic implications of all of this, and wondering what you think about it as we continue our discussion here on the Ideas Network. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the pipeline? 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'll be back with Barry Rabe in just a few moments. First, the news. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of WPR. My guest this morning is Barry Rabe, professor at the University of Michigan's Gerald Ford School of Public Policy and the director of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. We're talking about a big story that's getting kind of lost in the shuffle of the presidential race, the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's 1,170 miles long, and at peak capacity would deliver up to 570,000 barrels of Bakken crude a day from North Dakota to Illinois. But the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has sued in federal court, arguing that this project was not properly vetted with the tribe and that the pipeline would threaten its environmental and economic well-being and damage sites of cultural significance. Native American tribes and environmentalists have been protesting at the construction sites. The company behind the pipeline, Dakota Access, has stopped construction amid the demonstrations and awaits final permitting to come through. A federal judge is expected to rule on an injunction against the construction by September 9th, which is this Friday. So, listeners, what do you make of this situation? Do we need this pipeline, or is it not worth the potential environmental and cultural risks? And what questions do you have about the Dakota Access Pipeline? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also join us on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Leave your comment or question there. So just before the news break, I mean, the strategy behind the routing of this pipeline, I guess, is kind of what I wanted to get at, because there is certainly a refinery closer to North Dakota than the one any refineries in Illinois or further south. Do you know how we got to the route that is proposed for this pipeline? What was the reasoning there?
Sure. My understanding, John, is that this was really not driven by a government agency or Congress establishing the route. This was driven more by market factors and the pipeline companies working with the oil producers. Part of the issue here is just that the sheer volume of oil being produced out of the Bakken, mainly in North Dakota, but also some other states, is so large and could become even greater over time. The supplies there are just unbelievably large. There are alternative refineries, although we don't have an expansive number of large refineries in the United States right now, and that's also a challenge. So you have to kind of connect the dots where you might go. But my understanding is the thinking was going that Dakota Access route ultimately into Illinois would make it possible at that very large storage capacity in the small town of Patoka to then connect to a number of refineries and then move it to different parts of the country. I think what we're already, though, seeing in this pipeline, it may even come up in the Standing Rock Sioux situation, is it possible to route around points of controversy? this is emerging more and more whenever we talk about pipelines in the U.S. and around the world. Even electricity transmission capacity, for example, in Texas, which is now by far and away the largest producer of wind, an initial project to really connect all of Texas and provide the supply of wind, which is now pushing up to 15%, was originally budgeted about $6 billion. That ultimately reached $9 billion because there were so many landowners, farmers, ranchers, and the like, who didn't want the transmission lines going through their property. And by the time you add all of those links and hooks and connections, wherever you run a pipeline these days, that does add to the complexity and cost. I'm not saying we're there yet with Dakota Access, but you could have a number of questions and issues and routing decisions ultimately that would be made on this one.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it's pretty tough to build a pipeline of any distance without crossing a river.
It's very difficult. That's right. And, you know, this brings up specters of what happened in Michigan and the Kalamazoo River 6 years ago. And then we've seen other examples of this. It's very, very hard to do this. This comes up in throughout the Great Lakes also, by the way, with pipelines that, you know, run under the lakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you point out, though, there are thousands of miles of pipeline in the United States that operate every day.
That's right. And we are looking at an issue. Again, I think there's a rough parallel here with our bridges and highways. If we're going to remain dependent on oil and gas, those pipelines are getting kind of long in the tooth. And then as you look at replacement of existing pipelines, that raises issues as well. You have to open them up, pull them out, replace, and politically that's not always an easy step either. And now with this comes the larger question of how long we're going to maintain our dependence on these kinds of fossil fuels versus other kinds of alternatives. Although this is transportation fuel, we don't really see a radical or rapid transition to renewable sources for transportation right now.
President Obama rejected the Keystone Pipeline last year, and environmental groups are urging him to do the same to the Dakota Access. Do we know what the president's position is on this issue?
Well, this does become an interesting question. As I mentioned earlier, the international State Department type dimensions of this are not in play. Generally, permitting decisions regarding permitting decisions are sort of taken within individual states. So in this case, you had kind of connected the pieces of these four states, and there was approval, but ultimately some kind of federal component. There's not been a lot of public discussion in the administration on this, certainly nothing like the Keystone case. You're quite right. Is it possible that through some use of executive powers or oversight, environmental protection, could there be a federal interpretation to perhaps delay this, at least until the next administration? That's certainly possible. We don't know that yet. This has been a president who has been very active in using executive powers in issues related to energy and, for that matter, climate change. Much of the American federal policy in this area going forward is the president taking an existing law passed years or decades ago and applying it. Again, we're not there yet, but is that possible in the remaining months of the Obama presidency? Could this happen in the next presidency? It's a possibility, but there's not a lot of precedent for the federal government to come in and shut down a domestic-only pipeline.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program, 800-642-1234. What do you think of this project? Pipelines in general, but this project specifically. And maybe you're somebody who was planning to go out to North Dakota to join the protest, or maybe you've been out there. So share your stories with us at 800-642-1234. The Standing Rock Sioux, whose reservation straddles the border between North and South Dakota, has filed suit against the federal government in federal court for not being properly consulted about the project. The developers of the pipeline, the Army Corps of Engineers and others say, no, wait a minute, we asked you to consult. So what's the argument here?
This is the kind of issue we're seeing in, especially in Canada right now, where in Canada, First Nations groups roughly equivalent to Native Americans have begun to raise issues and questions about this. They are arguing potential risks and damages to important ancestral lands that are near but are not part of the reservation. The biggest single issue of this, though, is the concern about a possibility of a spill. Although what we're beginning to see is more groups that are coming in to support the position of the Standing Rock Sioux are kind of taking it a step further and saying we should stop drilling, or we should dramatically slow down drilling, or that this should be blocked to discourage the use of oil from North Dakota, the Bakken, or other places. And I would say in the last week or so, there is this very immediate, local, intense focus from the Standing Rock Sioux and their concerns in this Missouri River area that we've been talking about. But that then beginning to be joined from groups outside the area, national groups, whose position is kind of a leave-it-in-the-ground approach to fossil fuels, which is, you know, something that came up a bit in the Democratic primaries, presidential primaries, is coming up a bit more politically in the U.S., and this idea that it's time to kind of slow down drilling, and that literally by creating the pipeline, even if it doesn't leak, you're increasing or you're expanding the reliance on oil and gas, and in some cases, coal. So there's this larger issue that's beginning to come into play here, although that was not the initial focus of the objection.
We have a lot of callers suddenly who want to talk about this issue, which is no surprise at all. Let's take a call from Leah in Madison first. Leah, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am for the Indians. The Indians always get the dirty deal. How would like I because it might not they might not think it's going to be serious, but pipes have been broken and it affects the environment, and I think that also about their burial places that people should. How would they like it if somebody dug up their grandparents' grave?
Okay, Leah, we get it. That's a popular sentiment amongst those who support the tribes. This is a huge cultural issue.
You know, Leah, it's a very interesting point, and especially relevant in a state like North Dakota, where you have a lot of Native American communities and a lot of reservations, and indeed substantial archaeological work to find and protect burial grounds. There are actually a number of state parks and areas, territories in North Dakota that have been literally set aside from further use. Should also be noted in this case that the Native American communities there have actually been playing a pretty active role in drilling. One of the largest sources of oil in that part of the country is the Fort Berthold Reservation, Native American. And because they are tribal, they're actually somewhat independent of state law. I visited this community, and it is a vast territory and a vast oil and gas operation with a major reliance on funding that community and trying to help it with some of the economic dislocations. And so this really does raise an interesting question and puzzle. If there is going to be continued drilling in the United States, and continued drilling or even transport of oil across these lands, is there some kind of economic arrangement for Native Americans because of the unique nature of their lands and properties, the ancestral considerations, but also tribal lands don't fit traditionally under sort of local zoning or state control. We've begun to see a little bit of this in the Standing Rock Sioux case, and efforts in other places around the world to sort of negotiate a economic compensation package or support for social services and the like. But that then raises a whole series of other issues. But I do think that does become a question. And, you know, you're quite right. There is a long-standing history of exploiting natural resources in these territories and raises a wide, wide range of issues.
Let's take another caller. Kathy is with us in Madison next. Kathy, hello.
Good morning. I have to apologize because I missed your earlier conversation about why the pipeline needs to be built and why it needs to go to Illinois. But my question is, instead of spending the money on the pipeline to get the product to Illinois and refine it there, why can't the money be spent to build a refinery much closer to the source of the oil? And then if that were done, what changes? What besides the not having the pipeline, obviously, but it raises other issues because now you have to get the product into the distribution system. And how would that be better? I guess that's my question.
So Kathy wants to know, would it be better to build a refinery closer to the Bakken crude and then transport the finished product rather than the crude oil?
And, Kathy, this is a very, very interesting issue. There is a bit of refining capacity in North Dakota, including one that's not too far west of the capital in Bismarck. That said, there's not a lot of current refining capacity in North Dakota or some of the neighboring states, Minnesota and the like. Refineries are big, massive, and also extremely controversial facilities. And so there has been enormous political pushback just about everywhere in the U.S. over the last decade or so when new refineries are being proposed. In fact, many communities that host or live near refineries want to restrict them or shut them down. These are major, major industrial operations. They often tend to be located close to large transshipment points. They provide a lot of economic stimulus for a particular area. There are a lot of construction jobs, in many cases permanent jobs, but they're very contentious and controversial. So I believe the decision in North Dakota has been that they just don't have the resources and the economy of scale to put in big refinery capacity, and that's what's led to this decision. It should be noted that this is a very decentralized process. This is not a federal government agency, again, as I mentioned earlier, deciding where the refinery is going to go or drawing these lines. These are made largely by oil production and distribution companies. And I think, too, one real challenge that we face here with this is it reflects the fact that we're fracking for oil and gas. And so rather than 10 or 15 years ago, there were a smaller total number of places in the country producing oil. We now in many states have dozens or hundreds or even thousands of separate drilling operations. That in turn raises questions of moving all kinds of oil or gas from all of these separate points. This can be trucking or other kinds of pipelines. So along with Dakota Access and big ones like it, you have this network that has to be pulled together because it's such a broad, decentralized operation. And more than 30 states are drilling for oil and gas, primarily or substantially using fracking technology, including states like California and states in the South. It's a very widely spread problem right now.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Let's go quickly to Will in Windsor, and I'll ask you to be brief because we're approaching news time. Will, go ahead. Will, are you there? Hello, Will, one more time. No, I guess we're not going to hear from Will right now. Maybe we'll catch Will after the news. We are about 2 minutes away from another newscast. The Standing Rock are getting support from a lot of other tribes, including from Wisconsin. A number of people from Wisconsin traveled out to North Dakota to join the protests, environmental groups around the country. What are the protests themselves looking like?
Many of these started quite small. But you're quite right, John. What we are beginning to see are other groups coming into the situation. And I don't know that there's a sort of one immediate direct strategy, but it's beginning to kind of grow and snowball. The parallel here to me is probably a little less with some of the U.S. cases and more of what we've seen in Canada out in the west in British Columbia. And on the East Coast, both of which are major oil, gas producing areas, where there is a kind of consolidation of support there amongst the First Nation communities. And we're beginning to see that here as well. And I think what's also happening more broadly is Dakota Access is becoming a kind of a litmus test, if you will, kind of for the future of fossil fuel extraction. For a long time, Keystone played that role. It wasn't that long ago that we had people holding hands around the White House and saying, you know, stop Keystone. Well, that is stopped, and now this becomes the next piece, but with all kinds of different ramifications and twists, including this situation for the Standing Rock Sioux.
Hold that thought, Barry Rabe. We need to take a break for news. We'll come back, continue our discussion about the Dakota Access Pipeline with Barry Rabe, environmental policy expert at the University of Michigan. The pipeline goes from North Dakota to Illinois. What do you think of it? 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. The news is next. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Barry Ray, professor at the University of Michigan's Gerald Ford School of Public Policy and the director of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, about the Dakota Access Pipeline and the legal fight over its construction. Wondering what you think at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or you can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We had Will from Windsor, who called in earlier. We lost the call. We've got Will back. Will, are you there now?
Yes, thank you for taking me back.
Yes, yeah, go ahead.
My question is, wasn't that pipeline in the Dakotas originally supposed to run up around Bismarck, and it was later moved to the area around the reservation after a lot of protests there? People petitioned against it. And is it cheaper to run it, the route it's, that they're taking? Does money play a factor in this?
Sure. It's an interesting question, Will. And I don't know each and every point of the history. I do know that most of the major rerouting proposals have come not from Dakota Access, but the previous Keystone Pipeline proposal. In that case, there was a late concession by the proponents of the pipeline to make some major adjustments in shifts. Some of those involve Native Americans, others involve other communities. This is in the area that you're describing. So that's probably the primary case here. If you look at the actual map for this, it is pretty much a fairly straight diagonal line from, in essence, south of Bismarck to southern Illinois. Have there been shifts and changes and points negotiated along the way? I'm sure that's the case, but I'm not sure that's been as significant, at least until this point or moment. And so what we don't know is sort of where this is going to go. I think it's also, you raise an interesting question here in terms of the overall efficiency of this and how this has fit into life in North Dakota. This is a state that for about 50 years was losing population every census, was concerned about longer-term viability, and then you had this surge of oil growth. So there's been, on the one hand, tremendous support for finding ways to move that oil from the Bakken and all of this drilling to major population centers, and a recognition that they had a big, big problem relying very heavily on trains. It actually stood in the rail shipment corridors in places like Bismarck, and it's just almost unbelievable how many different trains with these tanker cars are going out from North Dakota. So this becomes a replacement for it. But with it are questions about efficiency, effectiveness, equity, and fairness. It's sort of the whole kit bag of the politics of siting a controversial facility like this, and not just one point, a refinery or a wind turbine, but a pipeline that cuts through all kinds of properties, and actually 50 different counties are involved in this.
Well, you mentioned the trains, and one of the problems connected with shipping the oil on the trains is that they take up so much space and they have a priority that, for example, coal shipments to power plants in Wisconsin have been backed up and have been late. And so this has been Wisconsin and Minnesota points where coal is shipped have had kind of disruptions there. So there's a real traffic jam on the rails. If we are going to produce oil, as you point out, we have to have some sort of infrastructure in order to move it, whether it's additional rail capacity or a pipeline. If we're going to take it out of the ground, it's got to have somewhere to go. Let's take another call. Jim in northern Wisconsin is our next caller. Jim, hello.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I've got a good weekend. You just talked about rail and, you know, safety-wise. I mean, right now the oil is getting transported by rail, a lot of it. And it seems to me that's a lot unsafer than building a pipeline. When you got rails, you're going over water. You're going over a lot of environmentally sensitive areas. And I would think a pipeline would be a lot safer. That's my comment.
Okay, Jim, thanks thanks for the comment. So, and Barry, you had pointed this out earlier about the difference, the risks associated with rail transport.
That's right, and I appreciate the question, Jim. And, John, actually, this also kind of links back to what you were just saying about coal and complexity on the rails. I think it's pretty broadly agreed across disciplines, across experts, that if you have a choice between rail transport and pipelines, neither are foolproof, but that rail may pose far more risks for all the reasons that have been stated here. And clearly what has driven the pipeline issue is not just the sheer volume of oil being produced, but that we've had some really, really unfortunate episodes, not just spilling gallons into rivers, as I mentioned earlier, but there was just a horrible episode that took place in a small community in Quebec about 3 years ago. And this involved a train that went roaring into something went wrong with the brake problem and basically incinerated a downtown in a small community in Quebec with a substantial loss of life. That was, think of the distance here, that was a rail train that began somewhere in North Dakota and ended up in a ball of flames somewhere in Quebec, a couple thousand miles away. So you're right, we've also had problems in building and expanding and upgrading rail capacity and making this safe. There have been efforts to try to change some of the cars and the travel mechanisms, but our railways are really, really clogged. And ironically, in this case, to the extent we continue to use coal in the United States, the environmentally most popular coal comes from the very region where the oil is being produced. The coal that's being produced in places like Minnesota, and actually North Dakota has some of this as well, is relatively low sulfur. And for a long time, Wisconsin and other states have been long very much concerned about sulfur dioxide emissions from burning coal. One of the ways we've dealt with that is by using less coal from eastern parts of the United States and substituting it from the west. And we're using less coal, but we still rely primarily on rail transportation. And in surprising ways, we've been relying very heavily on rail. So that moves us toward pipelines. But with that, this larger discussion of Dakota Access and pipelines.
Let's take a quick call from Greg in Superior next. Greg, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, first of all, I want to point out I don't work in the industry, but I do live in Superior, Wisconsin, and I believe that Superior is one of the only refineries in the state. I could be wrong about that, but what I will say is that we locally really, really support expansion of our refinery. And there is literally everybody I talk to is in support of that. And so your guest had mentioned that there's a lot of resistance to expansion or building of refineries. And I'm just going to say that I virtually don't see that. And we all know in Superior that it would be a huge boost to our economy and construction jobs, all sorts of different jobs. And it seems to me that the resistance to the expansion of our refinery, the resistance seems to be external, not internal. It seems to be coming from other areas of the country, even, that don't live in Superior and don't know our economy and don't know our culture and don't know what we need, and we need good jobs. And that's a problem. And so I would ask your guest to comment on that and maybe reconsider his idea that there's a lot of resistance to the expansion of these refineries. Thanks.
Well, Greg, I think it's a very interesting point, and I appreciate your raising it. We have clearly seen resistance to proposed new refineries, or for that matter, terminals in many parts of the country. And, you know, we can debate where the resistance for that is coming. We do have a number of terminals, including one in Michigan, not that far from where I'm speaking to you, that has been controversial for a long time, and I think there would be substantial resistance to any expansion. There have even been calls for closure. So this is a contentious issue. But you're right, and you know the Superior situation far better than I. There are communities that have welcomed this, have seen this as a source of long-term economic development, and there is a kind of longer-term benefit to communities from this because the jobs tend to last a lot longer than drilling operations. The oil keeps coming, or the fuel keeps coming. What I don't know in this case is how expandable the Superior facility is, what the discussions have been in your state about that, and what the restrictions would be. In other words, how far could Superior go? This also then gets caught up in corporate strategy issues. Where do the companies that are producing the energy want to send it? There are efficiency issues. There are corporate partnerships. In an industry that's gone through a lot of turmoil and a lot of change, and so I want to emphasize that I think you're quite right, and this is largely driven by, you know, proposals from large firms that either refine or produce the energy, how the system and government agencies responded to providing tax credits or tax incentives. Yeah. It's really the corporate strategy.
We're just about out of time, and I want to get to this. A federal judge is expected to rule on the injunction against the construction by Friday. Do we have any idea of how the judge is likely to rule, and then where would this go from there, whichever way this ruling goes?
I can't offer any inside information. I don't have it about where the court would go, but you're right. We should know in a few days what the decision would be. I think this is going to be one of these lower court decisions that's going to receive a lot of attention and a lot of scrutiny. I would say I would not expect this to be the final decision. I don't think you're going to have a judge or a court kind of lay out the rules that are going to stand. This is going to be, whatever is decided is going to be challenged immediately. And I would expect this to play out. The protest activity there is clearly expanding rather than declining. There's a possibility that this moves its way into election politics in those states, but also at the presidential level. I think we're looking at a much, much long game here, with the decision probably much more likely to be sorted out politically than maybe one final legal ruling, at least in the near term.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks for joining us this morning. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
That was Barry Rabe, a professor at the University of Michigan's Gerald Ford School of Public Policy and director of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. In addition, he's a non-resident senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. This hour was produced by Bill Martins, Niaja Ellison, and Brian Chasso. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.